The challenge is when you're a little sort of junior miner or emerging miner, and when you should build it is when nickel prices are actually low, and you'll catch the cycle when nickel prices come back. But you could just imagine rocking up to a sort of a banking syndicate and say, hey, you know, nickel prices are really terrible. We've got this project, you know, finance us now, you know. The only time you actually get the finance is when you shouldn't really be doing it, when nickel prices are high, and usually when other prices are high as well, so you can have a capital cost overrun on your project and all the rest of it, right? So he talks about why Rio didn't go into lithium 20, 30 years ago, you know, basically when the brines came in. And his thesis was actually, look, just be careful, because these brines are actually going to, there'd be so much brine production that you don't need the hard rock production, which was the case for a while. Problem with that is it collapses the lithium price, right? Because the whole of the cost curve is then becomes flat rather than stepped. You don't need the upper step, right?
G'day, money miners. We've got a treat for you today, don't we, JD?
We do. I am super excited to share this conversation we've had with Alan Trench. Can you tell the money miners a bit about him, Trav?
I'd be thrilled to, mate. We had the absolute privilege of sitting down with Alan Trench. And for the money miners out there that don't know who Alan is, well, I don't know where to start kind of talking about this guy's CV, because it is absolutely elaborate. It's filled with degrees, it's filled with companies, it's filled with badges, I would think of, that just add a bit of credibility to him.
Yeah, but he's got so much experience and so much expertise that it was just awesome to sit down with him and, you know, try and chip a bit of that off and sort of sprinkle it onto us so we could, you know, learn all those nuggets that he's been sharing. He's been writing the Strictly Boardroom articles once a week, twice a week for a long time with mining news. So
I'm gonna rattle off some of his badges, JD. So Alan, he, in terms of university studies, he's got his honours of geology at the Royal School of Mines in London, a PhD in geophysics from Glasgow University, an MBA from Oxford University. He's done a master's in mineral economics at the WA School of Mines, WASM. I think he taught at WASM for a long time, and he's now teaching the MBA out at UWA. So
yeah, so he taught the mineral economics course for a number of years at Curtin, and getting into the corporate side of things, he's worked at Western Mining, worked at McKinsey, at Woodside.
Yeah, mate.
CRU, Barrick.
It's insane, right? So yeah, you're right. Like, it's not just, he was a manager at KCGM there in Kalgoorlie. I think he then became a management consultant at McKinsey, which is
focusing obviously on the resource sector.
Yeah, a bit of a consulting mind to him, and then ended up in oil and gas doing some petroleum, with Woodside doing some work there too. At CRU Group, he's maintained a role there for a number of years.
Yep, he still does work for them.
He's a research house in the commodity industry, and he's still teaching at the same time.
Yeah, and on top of all of that, he's been a director and a part of a lot of small caps over the past decade and a half.
He has been a director, and let me just rapid fire list off some of the boards he's been a director of at various points in time. He's been a director of Acadian, Innova, Navigator, Venturex,
Hot Chili,
Trafford, Pioneer,
Enterprise,
Emerson. So there's just a handful of the you know, resources boards he's been on at various points in time too. I think above all though, he's a good bloke.
He is. He was great. So we, the Money of Mine team, caught up with him a week before we had this chat, and it was just awesome to sit down with him, and that led us to doing this chat.
It did, yeah. We asked him to join us in Money of Mine headquarters. And
the first in-person guest in the studio.
Indeed. The first person to come in, which I think we'd like to do more of that sort of stuff.
100% agreed. And to put the cherry on top, he's a Liverpool fan. So it just shows he's got great common sense.
I don't know about that one. That's a strike on the CV. But no, it was bloody brilliant. We're really keen to hear the feedback from the money miners on this conversation with Alan. I took a lot away from it. He talks us through the five rules for investing. It's particularly catered towards the mining sector. So, you know, right in the wheelhouse for the money miners out there. I'm still thinking about the conversation we had with him.
Yeah, it was a good bit of fun. And obviously it was a bit of a different style. We weren't talking about the mining news that has come out on that morning. It was a bit more timeless in a sense. So I'm really excited to hear what the money miners think of it.
Beautiful, mate. Let's get to it.
Let's do it.
G'day, Alan.
Hi, Trav.
Hey, mate. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
We're stoked that you've popped into Money of Mine HQ. We've had to rearrange the place a little bit so we could have a bit of a conversation rather than our usual. Normally, JD, Maddie and I are standing around the desk and you know, various computers and the likes, but we've got you sitting down in front of us today. I think it'll make for a different kind of conversation, which we're pretty excited about. I think we've been waiting to do stuff like this for a while, JD. So
people listening on the podcast, they won't notice too much difference. But we've actually got Alan in the studio here with us in person, and yeah, it's quite a treat. We got in touch with Alan last week, and he was kind enough to let the Money of Mine team come out to UWA, and of course, Alan writes the Strictly Boardroom article every week or a couple times a week in Mining News, and readers would have seen the 5 rules of investing earlier this week. So naturally we asked him to come and jump on the pod, and he was kind enough to come on. So looking forward to this one, aren't we?
Right, big time.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, guys. And look, the 5 rules of investing came from your prompt, right? So you got in touch on the back of some spruiking article that we put into Mining News.
The Immutable Laws of Spruiking. I loved that one. Yeah, that's great.
I thought, what could I write that actually seems to fit with your content? And I thought, okay, let's talk about investing. Why not?
I love it. Yeah, the Immutable Laws of Spruiking is one that I think I'm going to come back to in one of the questions we get to today. But yeah, I think it'll be really useful to our audience anyway to run through. Yeah, what these, the 5 laws. You wrote a longer form book that included more rules of investing, didn't you?
I did. I always say to my students at UWA, I've written 10 worst selling books, we sort of say. And I think that particular one was probably the worst of the 10, actually. So I sort of made people read 50 rules of investing of resources stocks. And so that was a bit long. So we just did 5, right?
There was a great line at the end of the book. Who would need to write a book on this anyway, at the end of the article rather? So.
Well, yeah, 50 is probably not the best like clickbait title. We want to put top 5 because, you know, at least our viewers can see that and think, oh, it's digestible. I only need to remember 5 things, 50. Oh.
That's right. I'm unscripted here, so I've got to try and remember the 5 myself.
I think it ties in with one of the things you said as well, that investors, brokers and the like only have about a 5-minute attention span anyway.
A 5-minute attention span, yeah, and the attention span of a 5-year-old. Yeah, that's basically it.
So Alan, where's your fun? Why are you the person to write the 5 rules of investing instead of you know, where's the fun to invest in instead?
Oh, that's good. Actually, no.
Are you launching one off our podcast today?
Yeah, so look, this is not financial advice. So I'm not a licensed financial dealer or advisor, but I have been sort of following investment in resources companies and making mistakes myself, if you like, for 30 years now. Yeah. So I suppose the rules come from, you know, things that I've done wrong over 30 years, and try and if you can avoid doing those, then you'll do pretty well, I guess. But I should say, you know, Australia and the minerals industry, both energy, has been very kind to me over the years, including a few wins and losses on investments. But I'm not trying to claim to be Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger or Benjamin Graham here whatsoever. But you know.
Oh, you've got the grey hairs, so we trust your wise nonetheless.
That's right. I suppose that's one of the things investing, you can still, you know, you don't need to be sort of physically fit running around on a field to be able to be an investor, do you, right?
And I think you signed the intro off so well by saying we'll depart from Buffettology there because juniors are just so much fun. And I think that's why Trav and I and Maddie obviously have started a podcast on the business and why we're so interested in it, because there's just so many great characters, so much excitement and different stuff happening all the time.
The payoff profile is so different as well, right? It's not, yeah.
Attracts a lot of personalities.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. The absolutely. Look, Warren Buffett wouldn't touch junior resource stocks in West Perth, I'm sure, right? You know, but within resources world, there probably are some Buffettology sort of takeaways that are probably relevant nevertheless.
Yeah. Absolutely. So should we get into it?
Let's do it, mate. What's rule number one?
Rule number one, does the company value pass the smell test?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the... And you guys are there, right? I listen to your podcast and you talk about company values all the time. So it's more of a guidance than a rule, right? Yeah, but just bear it in mind before you sort of buy shares.
Absolutely.
Value equals share price, right? You don't have to look at the number of shares.
That's right, yeah.
It's interesting to see how this one sort of fluctuates in and out of bull and bear markets, I find. So in the bull markets, you often get people who are much more, you know, they hold on firm to the idea of the sort of greater fool theory, and they're okay to sort of, you know, give the smell test a bit of a pass because I think, you know what, I can ride it. This commodity price is going higher or whatever, and then there'll be someone to take it off my hands once it's, you know, gone from up to a 10 bagger or whatever.
Yeah.
What do you do to sort of like back solve value a little bit? I'm assuming, you know, you're trying to see if the commodity in the ground can be extracted at a reasonable price. But what are some like just useful heuristics?
I think cash is cash, right? So you can obviously take that away and get to enterprise value. That's a sort of the simple thing. And then through following these sort of looking at companies over a number of years, you get a feel for what metal in the ground should trade at, you know? And the companies can't really say that too much these days on the ASX. They certainly can't talk about in-ground values. They probably can put up in their corporate presentations quite often, you know, their enterprise value per ounce, should we say, in a gold context. Yeah. And so you get a bit of a feel for that. But then you can also do the sort of the mental maths, and my mental maths isn't particularly brilliant, but you can sort of take what's the annual cash flow that these people are going to realize. So it might be the example I used here was like 100,000 of gold per annum, $500 margin type thing, perhaps after tax. And you sort of say, okay, great. I can calculate what that is. And then you can do a present value of that, which is basically just sort of multiply it by 10 to get a present value if you go long enough mine life. And then you say, okay, that's roughly what the market cap of that stream of cash flow should be.
So you're doing an annuity formula.
Yes, yeah. Which you should put up on the screen, actually, if you can find the annuity formula. It looks far more complicated than it actually is. You know, it's just effectively the annual sort of after-tax cash flow divided by a discount rate. And again, my mental maths, if you use 10% of discount rate, and therefore you just multiply the annual cash flow by 10. So that's one way to sort of thumbsuck it. The other way we talk about thumbsuck it is if you imagine yourself, if you're Andrew Forrest and you can afford to buy the whole company, right? So you look at the market cap of the company and you sort of say, would I actually buy the whole company for the market cap? You don't even have to pay an acquisition premium for it, right? You know, but and if you sort of say, oh, geez, I'm not sure. And that might be the case at the moment in some of the lithium producers, you know, the values have gone ballistic, right? So it's almost a case of if I had $15 billion sitting around in my bank account, would I buy the whole company? And sometimes you sort of say, well, no, that maybe not, you know, it's probably gone a bit stretched. So it's just one of the checks. These five rules are not like a weakest link problem. Like, you know, if you get 4 out of 5, you probably could still invest in something like that.
Absolutely. And you made a mention, I think it was in this point around commodity prices, and obviously forecasting future commodity prices is a bit of a fool's errand. And even though, you know, there might be a real consensus feeling that a particular, say, lithium commodity price is going to be much higher in the future, you never really know if it's going to go there via pretty low lows on the way, do you?
No, I was lucky enough, it's maybe 25 years ago, I think I heard on one of your podcasts that, or maybe it was in conversation with you guys at UWA, that BHP had finally worked out that they'd historically been a pro-cyclical investor where they really should have been a counter-cyclical investor, right? And so back in a master's thesis I did in the 90s, we actually modeled sort of almost like a Monte Carlo type simulation on the value of nickel assets at Kambalda. I was working for WMC at the time. And I found that really quite fascinating in the fact that you could then back out the effect of nickel price cycles on value and actually properly model that. So as an example, recently, now that Mincor's been taken over, you know, that's something where I did have the heuristics in my head because I've sort of done all that sort of math before. And you could sort of say, what's a decent nickel shoot worth at Kambalda, you know? And if you catch the cycle quite right, you might get 250 mil out of it, that sort of thing. If you're a bit unlucky, it goes down to maybe 100 mil or something like that. And then you could look at Mincor and just add up the metal they've got and what it should be worth. And, you know, at $2.50, $2.60, it was getting pretty sort of stretched. And that was like, well, luckily I had a few Mincor. So I said, okay, sell those. And maybe the price that it's been bought for, $1.40 is probably a bit more right, you know, but $2.60 wouldn't pass the company valuation sort of smell test. It's looking a little bit high. It could still be right if nickel prices structurally change, right? So you could do that math with, say, iron ore companies in the sort of 90s and early 2000s, and you'd be doing the maths on $30, $40, $50 iron ore and things like that and sort of saying, oh, look, you know, I shouldn't pay too much for it. But clearly what you couldn't see at the time, or perhaps Andrew Forrest could, is, you know, here comes $100 iron ore and here comes China, right? You know, and so that would change your maths totally, sort of thing. So So it, yeah, it depends on your outlook in it.
How do you differentiate a structural change in the commodity price? And I feel like, you know, that's one of the points you kind of don't factor in into the five rules is,
yes,
is, you know, what price deck do you use, right?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's almost like you almost don't need a price deck when you're running that. So you model a price cycles rather than a price itself, right? So, yeah. So I remember making that mistake myself in the late 90s when I first started looking at vanadium assets. You know, vanadium had a bit of a boom in the late 90s, and it went to $6 US a pound, vanadium pentoxide from recollection. And I built again this Monte Carlo model for part of my sort of MBA studies with a whole team. I realized I'd sort of fed the cells into it wrongly and effectively was spreading sampling the future prices wrongly, such that I was sort of structurally predicting major breakouts in the vanadium price without me even realizing it. And, you know, I was getting these phenomenal MPVs. But then when I actually properly modeled it, it sort of backed it out. So you actually don't need to sort of, you can model price cycles, which includes some high numbers periodically for a year or two. I think that's more realistic than sort of picking a really high number and just putting it off into the forever type thing. So yeah, so you can do it. It's wonderful what you can do on spreadsheets and with add-ons like At Risk and Crystal Ball and things like that.
Oh, none of those add-ons that investment bankers use, mate. We're just strict models.
And it's funny, you mentioned Andrew Forrest as well. Obviously, he thought Mincor did pass the smell test and he put his sort of money where his mouth is and just took the whole thing out. Yeah. I had one more point. I think you mentioned this when we caught up with you last week relating to the smell test and to various commodities. I feel it might have been titanium, but just getting past the smell test, looking like, oh, there's only perhaps two end users for a particular sort of commodity. That's a relatively straightforward sort of smell test to apply that investors perhaps sort of miss when it comes to niche metals that nobody's ever heard of or all of a sudden having a good run.
That was a fantastic one. That comes back to your Trevor Sykes comment, and I see you've got money miners on the coffee table here. Obviously, I'm a massive fan of Trevor Sykes' books and various things. And it was actually about tantalum that he said this in the late 90s. So, and we'd probably come on to it in one of the other rules. It's almost like, you know, at the time I was working as a management consultant in Sydney, and one of our jobs, we had a government job, we can sort of say now, and it was all looking at the sort of the future of IT services, hardware and software in Australia. And sort of it was all around, you know, what's Australia going to do in space? So it was trying to understand like all things like metals that go into mobile phones and all sorts of weird things. And tantalum goes into capacitors in mobile phones. And of course, mobiles were going ballistic at the time, right? So you were getting all these little IPOs coming up on tantalum, right? On some little sort of 2 meter wide pegmatite somewhere out the back of Meekatharra that's not never going to sort of move the world tantalum market. And the problem with tantalum is that there only are two buyers on the planet, or there were at the time. And Trevor Sykes used to say this in his articles, and one was Stark and one was Cabot at the time. But you know, just imagine yourself, you're producing some tantalum concentrate out of this sort of little tiny little pegmatite at Meekatharra. It's a bit like, you know, you're a dairy farmer trying to sell milk to Coles and Woolies, right? You know, there's only going to be one winner or two winners, and it's not you. Yeah. So on the one hand, these minor metals can be really structurally problematic to make money out of. But on the other hand, when we come onto it, you know, all the rest of the shareholders may not know that. So I was foolish enough not to invest in these little tantalum IPOs because I thought, oh, I'm smart enough to know that they're dogs, right? But they all went ballistic because like everyone just said, hey, tantalum's in mobile phones. I don't need to know anything else. I'm in, right? So that's the fun of not quite greater fool theory, but that's what we'll come on to about not trying to be too smart. Right? You know?
Yes, yeah.
I think we'll absolutely come on to that one on rule three. So let's get into rule two. If you listen to the managing director for 5 minutes, then ... Now, I really like this one. What do you think, Trav?
Mate, I actually... I've been thinking about this one. I almost have a physical reaction to it. It's funny, right? Because I'm a little bit, and you talked about your 10 immutable rules of spruiking. That was the article we read where we got in touch with you. You know, I think like I can see the part where it's so important to have an MD that is engaging, but how do you know the difference between engaging and spruiking? And, cause there is a difference, right? And maybe there's some overlap. Absolutely. But, that's a curious thing. I think I'd be curious to get your view on that one.
Yeah, I think there's a big difference. I think maybe one way, maybe this is another argument. I think I would ask an MD about safety. if you ask an MD, you know, how does your company manage safety? That's not something you're going to spruik about, right? But you can tell how they answer that question, how good a manager they are. Mm-hmm. And there's precedence for that. I mean, when I worked back at WMC in the 90s, my boss's boss, so to speak, the sort of the head of the nickel division was Mark Kudafar. He'd come down to give a town hall talk in Cambelda to all us sort of troops. And first thing on the agenda was sort of safety, sort of way ahead of his time almost. And you just, you're on the bus and you're bought in. Mm-hmm. And there's another great example in the safety context. Alcoa, you know, the CEO of Alcoa in the 90s, Paul O'Neill, if you find him on YouTube, you just, he's not a spruiker. He's not even any former salesman, but you just listen to someone talk about safety and you either say, right, wow, I'm on board with that. Right. So that's one way to, I think, just it's whether they're genuine and authentic. That sort of comes through in a subject like that. Don't cut this out, but I may have said it's a little bit like sort of pornography. You know, you can't define it, but when you sort of, when you see it, you know it, right? You know, and I think you've had David Flanagan on the podcast, and David's obviously got it, right? And it's, so whenever you talk to David, when I first sort of meet him and things, you feel like he's your brother, you know, he's just so engaging. And so I think you can tell the difference, but yeah. So ask the MD about safety and see what answer you get.
It's an interesting one as well, because it can almost be self-fulfilling in some sort of aspects. If you get the team humming, if you get investors and brokers and the institutional community on board, and then you get the share price up, and then the sort of cost of capital can become somewhat cheaper because you can raise at a higher price, it can be sort of self-fulfilling in a sense. So,
and there's some, we shouldn't, it's not just men, it's women as well, right? So in the safety context, you know, Cynthia Carroll did amazing things. But yeah, I mean, the acid test is, you know, would you put this person in charge of something more than a bus stop, right? You know, and if the answer is sort of yes, ticks the box, right? You know? But yeah, spruiking, you have to watch out for it. Having been on many sort of little company boards, I think the, what you don't see behind the scenes, obviously you see the public safe face of an MD, and there's a little bit of spruiking. It's part of their job to sell the company. And then they've got to switch off that mode. And when they come into the boardroom and actually, you know, get down and do all the hard yards, and some of that's not spruiking, right?
Yeah.
And one of the error types of MDs I've seen on the occasions is that they forget to switch off. And so they come into the boardroom and they're still
spruiking to the board members.
You have to sort of say, hey, don't stop. You know, that's for the external audience. There's a different expectation now in the board.
Love it.
I can think of a couple of, well, one MD in particular who was putting rocket emojis on Twitter up until the week before the company entered voluntary administration. But I think he could talk the talk on safety. But the towel was probably the rocket emojis on Twitter.
Well, you're looking for substance as well as style, isn't it? It's easy for us to say. You sort of know it when you see it, but it's very hard to define. But maybe we'd try the safety rule.
Yeah, I like it.
Rule number three, avoid being too smart or too dumb. So with this one, I sort of related it to what I said on point one as well, and it has a strong sort of correlation to what sort of market you're in. In a bull market, there's a sort of tendency to, you know, get a bit of alpha by, you know, not being too smart and just thinking these things are going to ride. And we saw a lot of that in
trend follow.
Exactly. Just trend follow. 2020, yeah. 2021, and just, yeah, trend following momentum, just getting behind things, and there's always going to be somewhere else. So perhaps, you know, skimping on the details, not looking into things, you know, while I never sort of endorse it, it sort of was a investment strategy that held quite a bit of water.
Well, I think you guys, obviously, I'm aware of your backgrounds, and I've watched your podcast stuff. So it's really, really good stuff that you guys do, and you get into the depth of things. And the danger of getting to the depth of things is that sort of getting too smart error type, isn't it? That you. So if we take, I know you've covered WA1, and I mentioned vanadium before, but vanadium and niobium are substitutes for each other in steel hardening, right? So I first came across niobium in the late 90s, and somewhere on my shelf is there's a 200-page sort of book on niobium, which I haven't pulled off the shelf for a long time. It's probably due to perhaps come off the shelf again, right?
So niobium pentoxide and vanadium pentoxide are the final products.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Now you're testing me, because it's definitely vanadium pentoxide. I'm trying to remember what the oxide number of niobium is. I'm pentoxide, not sure. Now. Yeah. Is it still pentoxide as well? Is it? And, and then you go to ferroniobium, a bit like you go to ferro.
Yeah, I think that's before, but yeah, I could be wrong.
But so in that context, you know, a too smart error type would be to sort of say, okay, I know all this stuff about niobium, all these challenges, you've covered it yourself, 100,000 ton market, growing at GDP plus type thing, that sort of thing. Not quite the sort of the EV energy storage thematic of vanadium type thing, but a better structural market as an oligopoly, and you've covered the great CBMM in Brazil. You can get into all that complexity and sort of say, oh, it's difficult. You know, it's not as easy as lithium. I'll sit back. But, you know, everyone else is just sort of saying, hey, every time they put a hole in, they hit niobium. They're going to do it again. Share price is going to go up, right? You know, so you can be too smart by sort of getting into all the complexities. But you're right. I think, JD, that's a bull market strategy, you know.
Absolutely. And it's kind of fascinating from Trav and my perspective because, you know, we haven't really lived through much of a bear market. We had a bit of a blip in COVID, and then last year I think the ASX 200 was off 5-odd%, but it'd be interesting to sort of see how that holds up for, you know, not just us, but our whole sort of generation of investors who at times might have been a bit light on detail, and sort of if we ever get to that point where the sort of central bank allows us to have a bit of a bear market, whether, you know, it ultimately ends up in a lot of retail investors leaving the market. So
I think of that, the risk of being too smart is pretty analogous to sort of being too confident with precision, believing the numbers in a model and getting overly confident with these numbers on the page. Yes, here are these numbers, they're very precise, etc. But you know, the more numbers and information in front of you, sometimes the less certainty there actually is. Yeah.
Actually, I was intrigued, and I listened to your piece on Azure. You know, the $1 billion valuation on Azure and various things like that. And then I think you showed a Euros graph.
Yeah.
In that, which was a little bit sort of scary, a bit, right? I'd never get away with that in academia.
No,
right? If I tried to publish that, I'd be actually shot.
No, like, well, you should see the level of thought in broker houses. It's much less than academia, I'm sure. Jonas and I both worked there.
Yeah. What it struck me was that, you know, that it comes back to that sort of value smell test type thing, really, isn't it? You know, the $1 billion or whatever, is it? That's a lot of, that's the sort of present value of the future actual cash flows, supposedly, of this business, right? You know, and it takes a fair bit to sort of bring in that $1 billion over and above what you've paid in a tough market to build anything in the first place, right? You know, so that's the one to sort of think through. I think in that company valuation, it's okay, look, here's a valuation of $1 billion, $10 billion, $5 billion, all these big numbers. You think, well, that's going to come in future profits and actually be discounted back to now for that number to be actually correct, right? Yeah. So it gets a little bit scary.
And when that deposit, you know, actually can produce, or, you know, can enter production, then what does the supply market look like then as well? And I think that's another thing that's
fascinating. I'm a big bull on lithium discovery, and lithium pegmatites are in what my exploration strategy colleagues would call an immature search space, right? Which is just glorified phrase for nobody's bothered looking for it before, and so therefore there's lots of this stuff to be found at surface, right? So a massive bull around lithium discovery in West Australia, and I actually think lithium it almost sounds cliche, but there is this sort of once in a generation type thing happening around lithium. So if you look back at the history of the periodic table, you know, in the 1800s, aluminium broke out, right? They actually finally cracked the code on how to get from bauxite to aluminium. In the 20th century, it was like uranium. The market for uranium was created, and similarly nickel broke out, right? And I think, you know, lithium's the sort of next one. So these things don't happen that often. Everything else stays niche for a long time, but I think lithium is sort of breaking out, and Australia's well positioned. That doesn't mean to say that I'm always thinking that everything always goes up in pure perpetuity, right? You know, clearly the good news about lithium is that there's lots of it. So most people think the bad news about lithium is there's lots of it. I think it's really good news because it means the market can actually become mainstream, that it's enough of it around. You know, scandium will struggle to ever be mainstream. There's just not enough of it around. Its rarity holds it back, right? The fact that lithium's not that rare is really good for lithium. But what it means in the long run is, you know, hard to hold the lithium oligopoly together, and prices will slowly sort of come down and we'll start looking a bit more like aluminium, but that's sort of good for the planet. But not necessarily holding up some of the valuations that may exist at the present time.
And what's the flip side of this rule, which is the risk of being too dumb?
Yeah.
Because I think we've talked about the risk of being too smart, but what's the risk of being too dumb?
Yeah. Well, the risk of being too dumb, the simplest one is the proverbial taxi driver tip, isn't it, right? You know, so that you, and there is a story of this. Nick Curtis, who I think I've got that right, was the founder of Linus Corporation, right? When Nick Curtis was running it in the 2010-2011 rare earth spike, which is prompted by the sort of trade wars between China and Japan, and the rare earths went absolutely ballistic up 10 times. And Nick Curtis got into a taxi in Sydney as the executive chairman of Lynas, and the taxi driver didn't know who he was and gave him a tip to buy Lynas. The market cap of Lynas at the time, I think, was almost equivalent to the sort of size of the rare earth market under a normal pricing thing on a revenue basis was akin to the... So that's obviously... Taxi driver thing is probably an example of being too dumb. Now, I'm a little bit worried now because some of my sort of MBA students are actually being given tips and things. And it's putting me off actually buying stock that I should probably be buying. Right? You know, but I thought, oh, damn, I'm hearing this from my MBA students, probably should be a little bit careful.
You just got to keep tuning into Money of Mine and get our view on it.
I'm amazed at the depth and how you find the time to cover it all, guys. You go into a lot more detail than I've had time to. And that's why I'm not running a fund, right? I've sort of got a day job, right? So, see.
Rule number four, don't try and catch a falling knife. Now, I think what people like Trav and myself, so in our 20s, call this just buying the dip. So over the last few years, it's just been the investment strategy to go to. Anything just comes off a bit. But in all seriousness, I think this is maybe more applicable in mining than in most industries. Now, that might just be because Trav and I are very focused on the mining industry as opposed to industrials or biotech or whatever. But things like grade reconciliation or, you know, metallurgical results, you don't see these just go away overnight, do you, in the sort of mining space? These are sort of problems that come around and they come back and back for companies, for deposits and so on. So I'm keen to hear your sort of thoughts on catching the falling knife.
Yes. No. Well, the phrase, I was lucky enough to, when I did my own MBA 25 years ago, or whatever it was, I did it, one of the chap I sat next to was a Chicago lawyer. Right? So he followed Wall Street a lot. And so I sort of picked up on the "don't catch a falling knife" as an old Wall Street sort of phrase type thing. But you're right, it very much holds true in the resources world, and particularly for companies that have single asset risk, right? You know, so if you've got a portfolio of assets, I mean, to be honest, I'm a Wesfarmers shareholder, right? That's my lithium exposure is I'm a Wesfarmers shareholder. I'm more than happy. If something goes wrong with Mount Holland, it's not a problem for Wesfarmers, right? That's it, right? You know, but if you've got single asset risk, and particularly, I think you referred to an Aaron Colleran LinkedIn posts about listing all of the work the administrators and the receivers are doing in sort of single asset risk gold companies at the moment. So, and somebody looks back far enough on my CV, I've had that challenge myself of actually being on the board of a company that sort of had a gold mine that couldn't make money in a decent gold price. When shares go down with companies that have single asset risk, and you guys have covered the various fledgling sort of potash producers in WA as examples, there's usually quite a lot wrong, and not accusing companies of that the companies meet their continuous disclosure obligations. Clearly they have to, otherwise you go to jail, right? But there's a lot happening. When one thing's going wrong, Murphy's Law strikes pretty quickly, and there's usually a lot of things sort of going wrong. So I would just steer clear. Things are cheap for a reason. Nothing wrong with buying the dip if it's a sort of an ASX 100 company with a decent balance sheet and multiple assets and all the rest of it, or buy BHP or Rio on a dip and all the rest of it. Single asset risk, I'd be very careful on
that. I think the pathway a lot of the challenging assets in mining go down is there'll be some issue pop up at a technical level, and then the way to remedy that issue in the short term is a very dilutive equity raising, and then the issue reappears, and then there's another very dilutive equity raising. And if the company can get through it at the end, if you held the shares all that time, the share price just looks horrible. So I think there's just a natural tendency for especially the single asset developers to be hyper exposed to this dynamic where shares just get crushed and new equity has to fix the problem, and there might not be a solution at the end of the day, and that's catching the falling knife.
Yeah, no, that's right. I don't have some form of superhero outfit on. I've been there, done that, and it's painful when you're on a board and you're having to go through that sort of cycle. But you can recognize it. And if you're not on the board and you're not sort of holding the baby, to mix metaphors, then sort of, you know, you can sort of steer clear.
And debt sort of compounds that dynamic as well. So, you know, I guess, does that, you know, fall into your thinking when you're playing in this space? Do you look for, you know, debt that's modest rather than hyper leverage in that single? I mean, I think of Calidus, they funded their project with 80% debt and a single asset developer, right? So, you know, if it all worked out well,
amazing for equity, but on the downside, some issues on ramp up in it. It's pretty hard work.
Well, actually, it's funny that some of the work we do in that Strictly Boardroom column, or just generally sort of trying to sort of teach mineral economics at a sort of postgraduate level and different things, you see these really sort of interesting things in the industry that shouldn't happen but sort of do, right? And I'm not accusing any particular company, but what a pattern that shouldn't be there but is if you look at the cost curve, like, you know, I'm joking in various books in the past and columns that 75% of companies claim to be in the lowest 25% of the cost curve.
You see that all the time.
Yeah. And of the companies that don't, they say they'll be there next year. Yeah. Right?
You know, but you still do a bit of work with CRU, who would produce a lot of those cost curves, right?
Yes, yeah. I do. Yeah. And so CRU, amazing company. But the interesting thing, if you look at the cost, you look at any cost curve of any particular industry, it's interesting that the level of debt in the cost curve is actually higher at the higher end of the cost curve when it should actually be higher at the low end of the cost curve, right? So you can gear up when you're a low-cost producer. But unfortunately, you know, it's the higher cost players that gear up, because it's the people that aren't geared are usually the tier one assets down at the lower end of the cost curve where they could carry debt, sort of almost don't need to. They're sitting in sort of in the majors. But to actually get things into the market, you need high coupon finance to sort of get yourself in the market. So the people that shouldn't have that much debt actually
do. You need to chuck it with them as much debt as possible, and then the equity size, the quantum, looks doable.
Yes. That's the theory, isn't it? Yeah. That's right. But it almost should be the other way around. And the other thing that the BHP example of the pro-cyclical and the sort of counter-cyclical, that makes sense for BHP to do it that way. The challenge is when you're a little sort of junior miner or emerging miner, and you sort of, let's say you've got a nickel project, and when you should build it is when nickel prices are actually low, and you'll catch the cycle when nickel prices come back. But you could just imagine rocking up to a sort of a banking syndicate and say, hey, you know, nickel prices are really terrible, we've got this project, you know, finance us now. You know, the only time you actually get the finance is when you shouldn't really be doing it, when nickel prices are high, and usually when other prices are high as well, so you can have a capital cost overrun on your project and all the rest of it, right? So the beautiful one, of course, was Nova Bollinger, that was actually built in a relatively weak market, and you can get all the A-team to build the project, and so therefore it comes in on time and budget, and it's a cracking asset anyway, sort of thing, you know. So that's what should happen.
Mm-hmm. I'd actually love to just expand on the cost curves that we see for different commodities, because Trav and I spoke about BHP. And the reason that Mike Henry said they don't want to go into lithium is because they don't see a steep enough cost curve, which I thought was really fascinating. And given that you've got the experience at CRU, just keen to hear how you guys think about, and the experience you have of the steepness of cost curves across various commodities.
Yep. Oh, look, love that. I can't speak exactly, because I don't have CRU's latest coverage of the lithium cost curve in my head. But it's interesting when we're talking to mineral economics master students and MBAs and things, that's exactly the point we raise, that sort of say, hey, look, lithium, it's just about hanging in there as an oligopoly, but there's a lot of sort of new entrants trying to get into it. The cost curve just worries me. Historically, well, the cost curve worries me slightly that it might be a bit flat, because most pegmatites are similar grade. They're mostly big things that you can open pit, Liontown aside as an example. Depends where they are and what the energy mix and the price of energy might be, but generally speaking, you know, not an obvious steep cost curve. So I can understand where BHP is coming from, and so, but for in the general context, the iron ore cost curve is the classic steep cost curve, right? Because you've got the fourth quartile all out of China, which you guys would know, and then the first and second quartiles in WA principally, and a little bit in Brazil. So you're $20 here, and then you're $100 at the top end of the cost curve. That's a beautiful steep cost curve. And you could also argue it's what's called a stepped cost curve, which is even better, right? You know, that's something. And interestingly, on the side, niobium has a stepped cost curve, which is fantastic. You know, it'll be on the lower step, clearly. but the niobium producer in Brazil needs to keep the high cost producers in the market. That actually is really interesting from a history of the lithium cost curve. And David Humphreys, who wrote was a former chief economist at Rio Tinto, wrote a nice little book. He talks about why Rio didn't go into lithium 20, 30 years ago, you know, basically when the brines came in, blew away all the hard rock. And his thesis was actually, look, just be careful, because these brines are actually going to there'd be so much brine production that you don't need the hard rock production, which was the case for a while. Problem with that is it collapses the lithium price, right? Because the whole of the cost curve is then becomes flat rather than stepped. You don't need the upper step, right?
Yeah.
So I think in the MBA world, we always talk about Michael Porter, the famous sort of Harvard sort of economist turned strategist.
Five forces.
And for the five forces, as to whether an industry is attractive or not using the five forces. A bit careful what I say. I shouldn't disagree with Michael Porter. It's probably career suicide. But you know, the one thing I think that doesn't get picked up that easily in the five forces is the shape of the cost curve. I think in particularly in commodities industries, that's critical. So zinc has a classically flat cost curve. That's one of the challenges of the zinc industry. That's partly where the phrase zinc stinks comes from, you know, is from the flat cost curve. Jury's still out on lithium.
Yeah, so as to and there's where, the potential for technology to impact that cost curve over time as well. In the case of lithium, this DLE technology, it was sort of pointed out to me that Sunrise in China might have some commercially capable DLE technology operating now in China. So like there's, I guess you're exposed if there is dormant like commodity sources out there that are just waiting for a technological catalyst to unlock, and maybe the brines was one in the past with lithium.
In the past, that's right.
Yeah, rather than the hard rock, then that's always another risk, right? It can change the cost curve dynamics.
Absolutely. And sometimes we get right and sometimes we get wrong, right? So there was a cobalt, you remember the nickel laterite cobalt boom of the sort of the 90s in Australia, right? Where all the nickel and cobalt was all going to be free, right? You know, we're all at the bottom of the cost curve, but the cobalt's all going to pay for all the nickel, so it's going to be zero cost nickel. And didn't really happen, right? You know, and
cost highly capital intensive, it turned out as well.
Absolutely. And then similarly, you've had seen things in magnesium in the past, right? You know, all the new, I think it was like Queensland magnesium was going to come into the market and going to be right at the bottom end of the curve. And so we have to be a little bit careful. Some technological risks, another thing that's another really interesting area we could get into, in the fact that people like to finance things that are low technical risk. And yet the breakthroughs are actually going to be, you know, so it's really quite funny in the mining industry. We all sort of champion, we're going to produce this metal that has all these new technological uses on the demand side that's going to make demand for this metal go ballistic. And so therefore, here I come. But I'm not allowed to have anything that's technologically innovative on the supply side because that adds to risk, right? So we have to do it in the normal traditional way. So it's quite paradoxical, actually.
Yeah, I think I'm quite guilty of this as well. When we look through company presentations and we see, oh, some sort of IP in the process, you know, in the metallurgical process or whatever it might be, and like already all the risks of getting a deposit into being a mine, and you know, even if they're sort of high percentages, you know, you times 90% by 90% by 90% enough times, and the ultimate outcome of the investment being successful can get pretty small. So do I want to add another one? But you're dead right. On the flip side, I might be like, oh, there's going to be heaps of uses for that commodity in the future.
All these new technologies. Yeah, that's right. Don't mention ore sorting.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, right? So yeah, so yeah, no, totally. The investors are pretty risk averse on the supply side, but they love technological development on the side, right?
We should make that the sixth rule, JDs. As soon as you see TM on any of the processing technologies, just don't invest.
Absolutely. So rule number five, dividends are good too, in brackets, as are conservative balance sheets. So what came to mind when I was thinking about this, specifically on the balance sheet part, and I think I've said it with most of the rules now, is the sort of market environment you're in. In booming markets, people don't really focus on the balance sheet. They focus much more on, you know, the blue sky upside and the potential cash flows and, oh, that income statement's going to look great. But then on the flip side, people focus on the balance sheet and they focus much further down as opposed to the higher part of the income statement. They look further down and is there actually going to be anything at the bottom line coming from the revenues? But yeah, just keen to hear your thoughts on why this made the five rules.
Yeah, oh, it's funny actually. I pulled the original book off the shelf, which I hadn't looked, you know, which had the 50 rules in, and number 48 was and don't forget dividends, right? So obviously it's gone up the charts, obviously, since from 48 to number 5. Maybe that's also the fact that I'm sort of 20 years on from writing that book, so maybe I'm a bit more interested in dividends now than I was 20 years ago. But look, I should give a plug here for I don't know the gentleman, but I've got many of his books. There's a chap called Martin Roth that writes a book every year called Top Stocks, right? And he puts a pretty serious set of criteria on. So companies have to be profitable for about 5 years to get into the book. They can't have too much debt. I'm not sure what gearing ratio we use, but they can't have that. They've got to pay dividends, et cetera, et cetera. So I sort of start there. I think, you know, it's almost like, and you almost don't need the latest version of that book because you can look up the latest, you can get the 2020 book and you can find out what's happened to 2023 and various things. But that's a very conservative criteria. So when I will go through that list of 60, I might pick four or five out of the 60, you know, using very conservative criteria. So if I can find a company that's basically not necessarily a resources company, but it's got zero debt, it's paying a dividend that's probably equivalent to the inflation rate at the moment, and it's on a price earnings ratio of 7 or 8, you know, it might be a really boring company. But this is almost like Warren Buffett investing, isn't it, right? You know, so it's almost like, rather than bubble investing, it's almost like boring investing, right? You know, so it's almost like find a company that's got a price earnings ratio in single figures, a dividend that's between 5% and 10% and no debt, and that looks, it's not blockbuster video, and that, as long as it's not that, then basically I don't care how boring it is, I'm happy to sort of go with it. So that's probably, well, I must be a bit careful, but that's probably the sort of the big end of town in the resources world, you know. And so
you talk through that I guess value investing mindset around looking for the dividends and the low trading rate multiples. And I think there's like a subsector within the resources right now that absolutely fits that criteria now almost more than ever. And that's coal.
Right.
So I guess like, how do you look at those coal companies? Some of them are trading at literally 1x EBITDA, forward looking EBITDA. The balance sheets are more pristine than ever. Huge cash, and they're either buying back shares or paying out dividends. But it's maligned from an investor perspective. So I guess, like, you know, how do you think of the compatibility of Rule 5 with coal stocks right now?
Well, it's interesting. I obviously, we're sitting in Western Australia rather than in Newcastle over in New South Wales or something like that. So I must admit, you know, coal companies, unfortunately, have been somewhat off my radar, leaving sort of emissions things aside or whatever it happens to be. But clearly, yeah, when you look at any company like that, you know, are coal companies the next blockbuster video to talk in that respect? You know, the sort of sunset industries. I did an exercise with the MBA students at UWA recently, and we sort of said, look, you've got the whole periodic table, and you've got till 2030. Do a meet, greet with each other, have a chat in your groups, but come back after a 45-minute chat once you've got to know each other. And I want to answer one question, which is, which commodity anywhere on the periodic table is going to do the best in terms of value accretion, price accretion terms to 2030? I get different answers each year when I give them that sort of exercise. But this year they came back with two. Came back with lithium, which is sort of interesting. That's what they came back with. And they came back with what they called oil and gas, which I sort of said, which part of like one commodity didn't you understand? You know, because you guys are on the right course, because we're going to explain to you that oil and gas is like not two commodities, it's about 10. You know? But I think they came back with oil and gas on the back of the coal story. So it's almost like, you know, here comes the sunset industry. Obviously, oil and gas producers are LNG, moving into hydrogen and all sorts of other, trying to apply hydrocarbon technologies and actually go into greener commodities, hydrogen being an obvious one. But I think that the MBAs were thinking, okay, this is what's happened to coal. Is it was like its time was supposed to be gone, and yet it has this Indian summer almost, if you know, would be the phrase. And they're predicting that for oil and gas. It's not a philosophical thing for me. I don't happen to have coal industries, but even though I do some emissions research, actually, we did a lot of research with a PhD student on emissions from the gold industry in particular, but I'm not taking a particularly green stance. It's just that I happen to live on the wrong side of Australia to follow coal companies closely.
It makes me sort of think everything kind of has a price, you know, like any sort of asset out there, there is a sort of price on it where it just becomes so attractive. And if you sort of get to the level where they're earning as much as you're paying for it, then maybe it's time for someone to have a look. You made another comment on correlation of risk in this dot point. And I think the example you gave was an explorer who's obviously got a high amount of career risk, very sort of cyclical, putting all their investments into explorers. And how do you sort of, you know, think about that and kind of advise, perhaps you teach people like this about their sort of portfolio, you know, obviously not financial advice, but broadening the sort of perspective. How do you look at it there?
Well, I think that one's close to home because you know, my training is as a geologist then geophysicist type thing like that. And so you get interested in geological companies and explorers. And so it's a very common error type in the industry that explorers, i.e. exploration geologists, invest in exploration companies and they're just doubling their risk type thing. Now, the counter argument is that, that who should be able to work out what an explorer's worth? Well, it should be a geologist, right? Okay. And to some degree, yes, so play with a certain amount of your portfolio in that space, but you know, don't be ridiculously overweight explorers if you're an explorer, right? So as your career. That's sort of pretty clear. And it's actually quite, well, two things to pick up on your point. I mean, you guys are financially trained, so you're familiar with the sort of market, efficient markets hypothesis, right? You know, it would be pretty boring if that was totally true because you wouldn't have a podcast, right? You know, cause yeah. If everything was worth exactly what it should be worth, then you know, because so clearly there have been sort of booms and busts and bubbles for 200, 300 years. You go back to sort of, you know, South Sea bubble and tulip mania, you know, that sort of thing. It's been around a long time. So things do get mispriced. In terms of exploration geologists doubling down on risk, without getting overly too technical about it, there's what's there's what's called a low validity environment. So a low validity environment for trying to work out what things are certainly worth or things like that is quite challenging. It's why active fund managers don't always beat the market, especially when that you include their fees and things like that. Right? The longer you're in there, you don't necessarily get that much better. So you can't always pick the winners, right? I'd argue that the best you can do is try and avoid picking too many losers, right? You know, that's about as good as you get, right? You know, would be my perspective on it. But yeah, what I mean by low validity environment is that if we got 30 geologists in the room here and we gave them 10 exploration companies to pick from and sort of say which one has the best assets and is the most highest chance of actually succeeding, I'm pretty sure amongst the 30 geologists, somewhere they'd pick all of the 10 companies would be picked, right? You know, but the good news, right? The easiest thing to find as an explorer is iron ore. That's not that hard to find. It's usually sort of sticking out. It's usually a hill, right? You know, there may be some environmental challenges and some sort of heritage sensitivity to the particular hill. But if you look at a particular hill, there's quite often you can find the iron ore. The next easiest thing to find is actually lithium. That's why I'm such a bull on lithium discovery in Western Australia. Out of 100 pegmatites, there'll only be like one to two. You can find the Joel Survey Western Australia monographs on this, like in terms of have the right chemistry. Otherwise, it's not just a case of rocking up at any pegmatite. It's only sort of one or two out of 100, but thankfully there are hundreds of pegmatites around. So
that makes me think of Azur, who we spoke about yesterday, who mentioned hundreds of outcropping pegmatites. But like you said, of course, they're not all going to be economic. But I think that alone gets investors excited, doesn't it?
Yeah, and look, I haven't. You guys have done more research on Azure than I have, but from the intersections I saw, they're pretty impressive intersections in holes. And the good news about I've been lucky enough to find or be involved in a company that's found lithium pegmatite. That was when I was on the board of Pioneer Resources, that now become Essential Metals. When you're onto them, though, pegmatites actually tend to, you know, you can add those tens of millions of tons that we saw in the Euros graph that you sort of threw up. So it is a little bit easier to sort of extend the tonnages in pegmatites than it is in extend gold deposits or something like that. You know, it is more in that bulk commodity type space of the iron ore that you can add resource pretty quickly. I'm very hopeful as a West Australian that there are many more lithium mines to come, including Azure, let's hope, you know. But obviously it's a little bit like trying to, I mean, you guys have your wonderful house here, Trav, but you, if we were buying houses in Peppermint Grove, right, you know, and someone said, you've got this fantastic house here in Peppermint Grove, you can have it for $5 million, you know, and you should be $8 or $10 million, I don't know. You can have it for $10 million, and you look at the house next door, it's just as good, and the going rate for that sort of house is $8 million. And you're offered it for 10. It's not that you don't like the house. It's a brilliant house, lovely house, but it's just you don't want to buy it for 10 million. You know, the value should be 8, you know. So that's the danger in some of these lithium stocks, is that they shoot their value.
Everything's got a price, eh?
Mm. I think you mentioned one thing, talking about 0.5 there. It's almost like you're the best you can do is to avoid the losers or the really bad ones. And I think, you know, the five rules in a lot of ways are actually, they're all that. They're kind of, what are the things to avoid almost? So the top five things to avoid doing. And that narrows you in a bit closer on, you know, the companies that you should be focusing on. I kind of like that. It's sort of success by deduction in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is. I think, and hopefully it sort of, it fits with this theme that I'm not trying to claim to be any Warren Buffett or otherwise. Like, I've made lots and lots of mistakes in my investing sort of career. I've sort of worked out that I'm never going to be that good. You know, I'll miss Liontown, you know, maybe miss WA1 or whatever. You can't be there every morning to catch everything and get every winner type thing, right? But if you just at least avoid some of the losers, that's pretty good. One of the nicest things, I mean, you know, Warren Buffett talks about, you know, it's not as if you can find a bargain every day or even every week or even every month. Like, you know, the one that I was lucky enough to get was the Chalice one, right? So I was running some papers on sort of the impact of COVID on markets, you know, and so it was March the 20th or something like that, 2020 or something like that. And all markets were diving with COVID. And luckily, just happened to have a look at the morning releases or something like that. And there was this sort of discovery hole from Chalice. And of course, the market had come off massively in Chalice. And I should have gone harder, of course, as you, with hindsight, right? But you could buy Chalice for the price with the discovery hole.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before without the discovery hole. And that's sort of like, that's crazy, right? You know, so the bargains do come along, but that's an example of picking a winner as opposed to sort of avoiding.
It's been a pleasure, Alan. I hope we can get you in sometime soon again to speak through another listicle article that you put out. That'd be great. And we enjoyed the chat. I think the money miners will love it. And get some good feedback. We'll absolutely ask Alan back into the living room.
No,
absolutely.
Hope I haven't bored you to tears, guys. hope I haven't bored you to tears or gone off on too many tangents. So I think of the five rules, we went off on about 20 tangents, so that's my fault, not yours. No,
that's why we asked the question.
That's why we got you here. Really appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.